And ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Great Lakes Waterfowl Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Miller, and this is powered by SuperiorDecoys.com. I'm so excited to be starting this podcast, and we've already had a great time talking with people about it and kind of getting ideas for where it can go. So in this first episode, we're going to be joined by Steve Schnatz of R&D Guide Service, west side of Lake Huron there in Michigan. And Steve is a world-class layout and diver guide, and he can get you on your sea duck. So Steve's going to be talking about what to look for when you're choosing a guide. He's going to be talking about safety and open water. He's also going to throw out a few tips that you might not have heard or maybe you've dismissed as crazy. So Steve's interview is going to be the first one this hour. And then after that, we're going to be talking to Brad Sanders, one of the owners of Dixie Decoys, based in North Carolina. But Brad's going to be joining us from his Marine Corps duty station in Australia. So we're really excited about that. These interviews are going to be enjoyable to you, we hope, as they are to us. And two great guys talking about how waterfowlers can make the sport better. And that's what this podcast is going to be about, improving the sport for future generations as well as ourselves and hopefully for the species as well. So thank you for joining us on the Great Lakes Waterfowl Podcast. We look forward to joining you for many more episodes. We'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Great Lakes Waterfowl Podcast. I'm Dan Miller here. This is powered by SuperiorDecoys.com. And we are back, and we have Captain Steven Schnatz. I'm not sure exactly. I'm just going to call him the Squaw King or Steve. Does that work for you?
That works. Right. Thank you, Daniel, for having me.
No, we're definitely excited for you to be on the first episode of this podcast. And Steve is the owner of R&D Guide Service. They're on Saginaw Bay. Steve, tell us a little bit about your season before we get going.
Well, it was a good season. I don't know if it was my best season, but it ranked right up there. Early October, we found acorns. And if we could get on the shorelines with acorns, we had wood ducks everywhere. More wood ducks than I've probably ever seen on the Saginaw Bay shoreline and marshes in my time hunting. Soon as they left, or even I guess soon as we switched gears, they didn't really leave till probably Halloween. But we switched gears and jumped right into redheads, bluebills, probably one of the better canvasback migrations I had seen in some of my recent years, through the middle of October, right through about the second week of November, which was fantastic. We also jumped right into some of our longtail hunting, which seems to be one of the most popular things in the upper Midwest right now on the Great Lakes. And no shortage there. They've been coming through thicker than thieves the last few years. And then as far as rolling through November, we've shot bluebill. Our redheads and canvasbacks kind of disappeared mid-November, but boy, our bluebills showed up, and they really ran strong right now currently through the end of season. Our golden eye has showed up in the last 2 weeks or so real thick. So definitely no complaints on our end. The birds came through. It was a good season. Very few days where I can say that it was slow. For me, a guy that's on the water every day of season, I would say we probably only had 4 days where not much was actually going on. So by far, a fantastic season.
So pretty good shooting for your clients. And that kind of leads into what I really wanted to talk to you about. I mean, like you said, open water hunting is really taking off. I mean, we're seeing it here in Green Bay really heavy. You're seeing it in Saginaw Bay as well. People get the impression that anybody with a half decent tender boat and a layout boat can go and do it. These long tails, if you're going 10 plus miles offshore, it's not exactly the best idea for a novice to just go and do it without really understanding what they're doing, right?
No. You need a lot of safety equipment. A lot of your typical duck hunters, they think that they can throw that old 16-foot boat they got and throw a layout boat on it, and it's all peaches from there. And, you know, many days it is. It's flat, calm water, and it can be a great hunt, and it gets very addicting. Numerous amounts of birds, decoying very well, and the temptation there is to get after them as much as possible. What I see as a captain doing it every day is guys that are running out there in these boats thinking that the wind will not pick up or can't pick up, ill-prepared as far as emergencies, whether that's being not having a way to contact the Coast Guard, VHF. You know, of course, I would always hope everybody's got their life jackets and layout boats, hand pump, bilge pumps in your boats that are working correctly. All too often, I'm seeing a lot of these boats that look like they're just kind of scabbed together, which, you know, they might suffice in your local pond or little small body of water, but the Great Lakes can eat up a big boat, and most certainly a little boat in a matter of minutes. I worry all the time too, even what I do every day of the week. If I'm out there, hypothermia is a huge concern. I've seen layout boats flipped. I've seen guys in the water, and it only takes a matter of minutes before you lose all feeling, and things can go south in a hurry. So safety is just, it's huge. And I think a lot of duck hunters take it for granted. And it's not that, you know, a lot of people think it's, I would turn down competition, and it's not that at all. It's more of a safety concern for me. I'd hate to have a hunter not make it home to see his family at the end of the night. I do a lot of things that I take for granted that a lot of other people probably don't do. An example of that would be is I file a float plan every morning with somebody. Somebody in my family or a friend knows where I'm going every day, about what time I'll be back in, and I have check-ins, and they need to hear from me. And if they don't, they can notify whether it's the Coast Guard or a local sheriff's department. And I highly recommend all big water duck hunters do that. Too often people disappear, and or they don't know, or their family doesn't know what time they're going to be home, and it's good to do that. So anyways, file a float plan. At least tell people where you're going and when you think you're going to be back. Something else I see a lot of, and again, we don't always have a buddy that has the same day off of work, but I see a lot of solo hunters. And again, there's something to be said for peace and quiet and a little solitude. I get that. I hunt in the marsh by myself occasionally too, but again, it's never a bad idea to go out hunting with a buddy. Things can happen, and sometimes an extra hand can make all the difference in the world. Something I also do as a captain that a lot of people never know, if I've got a small group of layout hunters, and I run two layout boats, and if I have hunters in both the boats, and it's just me in the tender boat, heaven forbid, if something ever happened to me, my hunters may be in a serious world of trouble. And I actually tethered myself into the tender boat on days when I have a small crew. That way I can't fall out of the boat, and I can make sure that we all get in at the end of the day. Again, so it's just some personal steps that I take to make sure that everything goes smooth. And, you know, we're out there hunting cold water, cold weather, snowing, blowing. If I was to fall out of a tender boat, who would get my guys in the layout? You know, so that's always a concern to me. So just some little things, like I said, very, very safety oriented. It can kill you out there. It's a lot of fun, and I would encourage it to anybody, but it can kill you out there. A 5 to 10 mile run, heck, you know, really, even a half a mile out, things can go wrong in a hurry. 100 yards from shore, if your boat's taking on water, whether it's from waves or leaking, again, in 5 to 10 minutes, when your body starts in the paralysis, chances are you're not going to make it home, you know, that night. So definitely some things to consider.
Yeah, the good duck weather isn't exactly boating weather.
No, and, you know, sometimes you don't have the room. But even if you pack it in your vehicle, I generally always recommend a change of clothes, you know, some extra shoes, lots of extra gloves. If you've got the room, of course, you know, heaters and things like that. But, you know, I get some guys, they'll get wet and, you know, we can kind of strip them down quick and change their clothes sometimes on the water or even just back in the parking lot. And it can make a world of difference and be thankful that you did. So
for the guys that aren't really experienced, they want to learn the ropes or they want to experience layout hunting, which, like you said, it's a blast. I mean, having ducks decoy right into your face and they have no idea you're there until you shoot them, or I should say shoot at them. We took a lot of guys layout hunting this year for the first time, and it was pretty comical. A lot of birds got educated.
Oh yeah,
but it's tough shooting. But the guys are looking to book a charter, trying to find a guide to take them out. Can you talk a little bit about how someone can verify that you're licensed with the Coast Guard and that your boat's inspected and that you're a safe person to go with?
Yep. You know, the biggest thing is definitely if you're going to book a charter. Or even if you're just going to go with anybody, and something I recommend to any hunter that has never done layout hunting or wants to become better at layout hunting, even outside of a charter, is yes, you definitely want to make sure you're going with safe people. You want to ask around, talk to a lot of people. Word of mouth is great. Now, if you're going with a licensed charter captain, you can easily call the state of Michigan, the DNR, your local or even non-local Coast Guard stations. All these phone numbers are, you know, really easy to find online with a simple Google search and ask them. You can call on me and you tell them my name, you tell them my business name, ask if I have a Coast Guard captain's license, which is required on the Great Lakes for fishing or hunting. You need to ask if the boat has been inspected, and that is a marine survey and inspected by the state of Michigan by a conservation officer. And that all has to be done. We also have stickers on our boats that say we've been passed. We also have a list of safety features on our boat that I generally go over with everybody every morning before we get started. Usually on the boat ride out, I'm going over all the safety things, where the life jackets are, what would you do if the captain was to, you know, fall out of the boat or something was to happen to me. All these things need to be taken into account. And like I said, if you call your local DNR or state DNR or the Coast Guard, they can give you all that information by telling you yes, this captain has or has not went through all those legal requirements. As a legal captain, we are required to carry insurance, liability insurance specifically. And again, it's just the little extra features that are going to make sure you're safe when you're out hunting. A lot of guys, you know, they want to get you out hunting, non-licensed captains, and, you know, make a few bucks. And you got to be careful with that. It can get you in trouble, and it can, or more importantly, you know, if an accident was to ever happen, you know, what's going to happen from there? So definitely some good things to take into consideration when deciding if you want to go on a charter or not. But before you go to all that trouble, make sure they're credible people and they're safe people. You know, you hate to say it, but not everybody that owns a layout boat is a safe person.
That's an understatement. Now, you run Layout Addictions Pro Guns, correct?
Yes, I do. I do. You know, that's a good topic too. I run the Layout Addictions Pro Gun. Great boats, very light. Now, I don't know if they're, you know, considerably lighter than a fiberglass boat, but for a guy like me who beats on them you know, 5 days a week. They hold up very well. But there are some fantastic glass-made boats out there as well. Now, there are some other boats that Layout Addictions and some of the other layout boat companies make that can hold a heavier hunter. So if you are a new hunter looking to get into layout hunting, make sure your layout boat is built to the specs of the weights you're going to put in it. Basically saying you're not going to put a 300-pound guy in a layout boat that's at 150-pound man rating. Again, a lot of people overlook that. They think, well, I want a smaller layout boat because it hides better. But again, you got to go by the weight ratings. The pro guns for me typically fit most guys that I would take hunting. Now, I do have to say occasionally I'll get some bigger guys. And unfortunately, they don't fit in them real well. And myself as a captain, I may have to look into getting another larger boat just for that reason to get guys layout hunting. You're laying on your back. You got to be able to do some sit-ups real fast to shoot at birds. So you do have to be somewhat in decent shape to do layout hunting. It's not, you know, we're not sitting on a chair or a bench and, you know, shouldering your gun. You know, when the birds come in, you're doing a sit-up. And if you can't do a sit-up, you know, you're going to have to start getting into some shape.
Yeah, it's a bit rough. I just looked it up. The ones you run, the pro gun, has a weight capacity for the person of 243 pounds. I believe the aluminum layout boats, you lose a little bit of the weight rating versus fiberglass because of the lack of buoyancy of the aluminum itself. Mm-hmm. So a comparable size fiberglass boat will hold a bigger person in theory. But I agree. I mean, the aluminum for us has been the way to go, just being able to beat it around and not have to worry about holes in the fiberglass or anything like that.
Yeah, that is for sure. That's kind of the new age thing. And, they are a nice boat for, like I said, someone who wants to, not really take care of it real well. They don't waterlog and, you can just flip them over at the end of the year and you're good to go. You don't have to worry about weather checking and cracking from the sun or the wind and the rain. I literally take my layout boats and I put them on sawhorses and they're out in the backyard upside down all year. The worst thing that happens to them is the sun fades the paint, so which is no big deal. And the cool part about the Layout Addictions boat, and it's a super fast, quick, and easy way to change out the spray shields if they do get damaged, ripped, torn, broken, which I do like. I hunt out of my Layout Addictions about 4 to 5 times a week, and guys aren't exactly nice to them. They're jumping on them, kneeling on them, putting their hands on them, and my spray curtains have taken a beating, and I'm going to have to actually order another set here pretty soon, but it's a quick and easy change out, which I really like. That's a neat feature that Mark put on them.
Yeah, I don't know about you. I don't really have any interest in duck hunting gear that I have to baby, whether it's decoys or a boat or anything. I'm going to beat
exactly.
It up.
Exactly. So. Yep. If you're gonna be a pretty serious waterfowler, your equipment's gonna take a beating and you need it to hold up. So that's definitely some things to look at if you're making an investment into equipment, whether it's again, you know, the layout boats, decoys. I mean, as a diver hunter, everybody knows I've got mountains of decoys. I'm going to be having a clearance myself here probably next summer. I've got right around 700 or 800 decoys still, and that's down from probably 1,000. And, I run about the same 3 dozen all year, foam-filled or, some of these newer style. I know you personally have a new decoy that's super tough and can take a beating. And again, for these guys who are getting into the sport or, you know, maybe changing up the going from a puddle duck hunter to a diving duck hunter or sea duck hunter, whatever it might be, get some decoys that can take some shot because they're going to get punished. No doubt about it.
Yeah. And the bigger and bolder the decoy you can get, I think the better. I don't think it has to be the best looking decoy or the best.
And you know, I hate to give out all my trade secrets. But I will give a little tip to some guys that visibility is huge. If the ducks can see your decoys, and I use the word decoy loosely, if the duck can see your spread, let's word it that way, the better off you are. I didn't have to do it so much this year. We had a lot of windy days, and the days that I got out after the divers and even these sea ducks, they hadn't seen a lot of hunting pressure, so I just ran a typical, really, it doesn't matter whether it was long-tailed ducks, redheads, bluebills, cans. I never ran more than 3 dozen decoys all year. And, you know, it used to be everybody kind of thought, well, you're going to have to run 5, 6, 8, 10, 12 dozen, you know, all these long strings. And I really cut down this year, but due to hunting pressure, weather, I don't think I really needed it. But gotten a little off topic here, but as far as being seen, last year I started doing a lot of experiments. We kind of joke around. We all got that one buddy who, you know, says, well, I'm going to use milk jugs and bleach bottles, and they do work without question. I took it up a notch higher. I started doing some hunting last year towards the end of season, and even a little bit this year with 5-gallon pails, some white 25-gallon drums. And it's amazing how many hunters came up to me in other rigs at the end of the day or when they saw me at the dock, and they asked me if I was using swan decoys. And no, I wasn't using swan decoys, but everybody could see my spread, but so could the birds. And that was a little bit of an edge. I mean, I could suck birds in from a long ways with just a few pieces of equipment. Now, I'm not running 35 of those, but 3, 4, half dozen in a decoy spread can make a huge difference mixed in with your regular duck decoys. You call them in from a distance, and then you can finish them with some better decoys. Flagging is a great way to get some ducks to come into your spread too. As a lot of new hunters, though, you got to be careful that you use the flag to get the bird's attention. I had to take flags away from a lot of my hunters and layouts because they wanted to flag the birds right on past the decoys. So there gets to be a point where you got to put the flag down and start shooting at them too. But movement and being seen can really help out a hunter. And you know, like I said, you don't necessarily have to have the most expensive decoys on the market. A few to finish the birds, get them feet down to land. But getting seen is a whole other story. So a little bit there to scratch the surface for guys to think about.
Yeah, I think the over-visibility on the big water, I mean, if you're driving or riding your boat or whatever you call it, I don't know, driving, captain. Anyways, mm-hmm. you're going through the water, and if you have any sort of chop, you're not going to see those ducks until you kick them up. And you think, and it's the same for the ducks. I mean, these divers are flying 1 foot, 2 feet off the water. And that's a really good point.
Exactly. Yep. And, you know, as far as a lot of people ask me, they say, well, boy, I can't believe you would throw, you know, a bright white 5-gallon bucket or a 25 or 35-gallon barrel into your boat as a decoy. Well, a lot of these birds, I'm watching them out on the Great Lakes, things that they're used to. They're used to commercial fishing nets with big white flags or bright orange flags. They're used to, you know, buoys. A lot of these birds are coming out of the ocean. They're used to crab pot buoys. Things like that, lobster buoys. They are used to seeing channel markers with lights on them, whether that's a green buoy or a red buoy. They're used to seeing these weather station buoys. And a lot of times when we're out driving the boat around scouting for birds, they're sitting next to these things, so they're very comfortable with these things. I have been joking around for a couple years now about the potential of painting both my layout boats one bright red, one bright green to imitate channel markers, because I believe the birds are so accustomed to seeing them. And everybody laughs and laughs, but my boats are at the point right now, they've been beat up and scratched up so much, I got to paint them. And 2020 might be the year that guys show up to hunt with me, and I got a red boat and a green boat. So we'll see what happens there. But it's all about knowing the environment, watching what the birds are doing, where the birds are landing, being visible. It's not always about camouflage. It's sometimes about, you know, mimicking what they're landing by and what they want to be by, what they feel comfortable by. So just, again, something to keep in mind. I've had some fantastic hunts where, you know, even out on the Great Lakes, I've watched mallards flying in and out of marinas. And if you take a camouflage duck style type hunting boat and you park it there, they know it's out of place, and they will flare off that, you know, a lot. Now on the contrary, I've seen some guys and go as far as they say, okay, we're going to leave the duck boat at home. And I met a guy a couple years ago. He took a bright red fishing boat and anchored it right off the front of a marina, and he was fishing, and he had his gun in the boat, and he shot limits of mallards on and off most of the season out of his bright red fishing boat, because again, the ducks were so accustomed to seeing that stuff, it wasn't a threat. But now, had he parked his camouflage duck boat there, you know, he may have had a different season. So again, it's amazing how you can fool birds just by being perceptive to what they deal with on a daily basis all year long.
And how you could do everything perfectly by the book and have the best blind and the best decoy spread and everything, and they flare off it because they've been seeing that for the last 2 months.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, I love, you know, another thing, I love boat blinds. They're comfortable. You can throw them up, you get under them, keeps the wind off you, keeps the rain off you. But again, as I'm driving up and down shorelines, a lot of times I see the boat blind, another person's boat blind, well before I see their decoys or anything else, and so do birds. And birds can pick that out as danger because they've seen it. They've seen it all the way from Canada, and they will see it all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico, wherever they end up. So I've told a lot of hunters, you know, they say, well, okay, you've killed, you know, a 3, 4, or 5-man limited ducks, and we struggled to get three today. And I say, well, you know, I hate to tell you, but, you know, ditch the boat blind. It'll make a big difference some days. And they say, well, you know, they can't see us inside of it. Well, no, they can't, but they can see the boat, they can see the blind, and that alone to them is sometimes a signal to danger. Now, I'm not going to tell you I'm against boat blinds, because there are days that I would love to be in a boat blind, whether it's a big cedared up pontoon blind. I'm all for that. Comfortable hunting, and definitely birds will be killed out of them. You know, I'm not saying they don't. A lot of guys run them. Some of my good friends have pontoon cedar blinds, and they're fantastic. I might even look into putting one together. But sometimes if you're about the numbers, you want to stack up bird numbers. Again, it's about getting creative and figuring ways to trick the birds so they know that you're not there. And again, kind of back what you just had mentioned, you know, you think you've got the perfect decoy spread, whether it's 5 dozen decoys and 3 spinners or, you know, whatever your idea of that is. A lot of times I go out in the afternoons and, you know, again, I get clients that look at me like I'm crazy because I've got, you know, 6 decoys in the boat. And, it's all about being in the right place at the right time. And you can by far kill more birds with that logic than any decoy spread or any boat blind that you could ever imagine. So there's just a lot of little things that hunters overlook. Again, I use this term a lot, and it surprised me you just said that in fishing a lot. But it's like, what does the book say you should do? And what should you actually do often are two different things. And it's good to distinguish between the two.
I think it's safe to say that if a technique or something has shown up in a magazine the Ducks have probably seen it long before you have.
Yeah, well, if you were to stand at a dock and you were to take a poll of every duck hunter that showed up on a busy Saturday, you know, everybody's going to have, or a good majority are going to have, a similar type boat blind, whether it's a fast grass blind or something similar. You know, they're going to all have the 3 to 5 dozen decoy spread with a mixture of long lines and a few single drops. And they're all going to go out and hunt the traditional same spots that they've hunted for the last, you know, 20 years, let's say. And are they going to get some birds? Well, of course they are. But again, if you want to be a better hunter, it's just like anything else, hunting or fishing. You want to be able to pick up on little key differences that can make or break the difference between you and another hunter out there, whether it's a bigger spread, whether it's a smaller spread, whether you're basically invisible, whereas another boat is sticking out, you know, stuff like that. And a lot of guys, they don't think about it. Now, a lot of guys don't care. I've got a lot of friends that I love hunting with them. They have the attitude, you know what, we're just going to go out, we're going to sit in the boat, whatever comes in, and it was a successful day. And those are my kind of people too. But, you know, again, if you want to really get out there and get after them some days, you got to put in a little more effort and be perceptive to what's happening.
So we actually had a day this season where we went out and a friend messaged me, asked me if I could take him out on a hunt the next morning. Of course, he's not from the area. And said, hey, can you get me out on a hunt? And I said, sure. But I hadn't had a chance to put the boat blind on. And of course I got a beaver tail, best boat blind out there in my opinion. But, you know, I didn't have time to put the blind on. I got in town late the night before I was going to take this guy hunting. And he and I and another friend went out in the morning. I said, this is pretty much a crapshoot. I don't know if it's going to go anywhere. I don't know if we're going to kill any ducks, but I think this is a good spot that I've scouted, and we'll see if the ducks do it today. Well, due to thick fog and everything else, we actually ended up at a spot different than where I intended to go. I'm not very proud of it, but that's how it went. We ended up setting up like 300 yards away from where we wanted to be. And we were pretty much not quite set up as shooting light came, and we're cooking breakfast, of course, because that's what we do. No boat blind, the boat's exposed in the water. And I mean, plain as day, not exposed in like tall cover, like you and I hunted in. I'm talking exposed in cover that's maybe 12 inches above the waterline. So the boat's really obvious. No blinds, no grassing, no nothing, just a brown boat. And it's hanging out into the channel, the motor and maybe the last 5 feet of the stern. I mean, any duck or person or anything could have seen it. It was so obvious. And, you know, no sooner shooting light came and birds just started dumping in. It was the most unreal hunting experience I've ever had. Birds, we didn't shoot anything over 15 yards. We were just, I mean, multiple different species, divers, puddle ducks, a whole 9 yards. I think we ended up with 7 species or something like that. It was just one of those days you tell your grandkids about, you know. And we had no boat blind, and the boat was painfully obvious. And so, you know, like you said, you pretty much, there are no hard and fast rules. You have to adapt to the birds. It's, the reality is that they change just like we do. They get conditioned to different things. And you're right. They'll pick up on a boat blind occasionally. And depending on what the birds are doing, you might need to change things up. So I think you bring up a lot of really good points. The best tool we have as duck hunters is choosing to be adaptable and choosing to change things up, because the birds don't get stale, in my opinion. We get stale. Our hunting techniques get stale. And that's just how it is. So, yeah, I appreciate sharing that. You know, I sell a lot of boat blinds. That's just a fact. And I'd be happy to sell a million more. Sometimes, though, it needs to be ditched, just like you said.
Now those are the days that all hunters can hope for. That is, you know, the stars aligned kind of a day.
It is, you know, and the Ducks did it right, but even on those days when the Ducks really want to do it right, and you would think that not having any sort of hide and having three guys wide open frying up bacon and eggs on the front of the boat. I mean, I had my long lines on big orange cord reels. Those orange cord reels were in the wide open. They flew over. I mean, they would circle us like once and then dump in. But I guess I'm saying all that to circle back to what you were saying. People need to adapt to the birds in their area and realize that there's no single technique that'll go out and kill birds every single day of the season. No single spot, no single blind setup or layout boats sometimes don't work, especially, I mean, I'm here in Green Bay right now, and the Ducks have gotten really wise to layout boats here.
You know, and it's funny you mention that. I'll step in on that real quick. Something that I've noticed in just a 5-year cycle is when I was really big into layout hunting specifically for redheads and bluebills, when I first got into it, it was lights out hunting. I could take a layout boat, throw it out there, and I could have a 4-man limit by 9 o'clock. We could come home, have breakfast. But as the layout boats, you know, popularity started to increase, more and more hunters were getting out there, and these divers, again, like you said, they were like, hey, that's a layout boat. We know what's going on. We get shot at when we fly by those things. And the diver hunting got tougher. Without question. And so I started getting clients that would say, well, we want a diver hunt and we want a layout hunt. And I would always ask the same two questions. I would say, well, do you want to layout hunt to say you layout hunted, or do you want to diver hunt and get divers? And that was two different things, because a lot of times I felt like I could put guys in the marsh. I've got spots where we can hide. And effectively, we would kill better numbers of ducks versus being in the layout boats. Now, if you wanted to layout hunt from an experience, well, so be it. But we may not kill nearly as many birds as if we're hiding in the marsh in some of these places where I wanted to be, where the birds were feeding, where they were resting in the afternoons, whatever. But now, recently, within the last couple of years, so many hunters now have dropped the ball on the divers and have 100% jumped in every available weekend hunting the long tails offshore, that that the layout boats, again, are now becoming pretty effective for redhead and bluebill hunting and golden eye and everything else that's out there too. They don't seem to flare off them like they quite were. And again, nothing has changed. I'm hunting the same boats now that I was 5 years ago. But on a typical Saturday, when I was seeing 14, 15 different rigs with a couple layout boats each hunting redheads and bluebills, and the birds were getting smart to them from hunting pressure, those guys are all out long tail hunting now. And some of our diver hunting from layout boats have gotten better. So again, it's all about adapting. You got to watch what other hunters are doing. You got to watch what the trends are. And it's amazing how birds change just based on little things like that, that, you know, again, most guys would never think about. And again, now the day you were up there with Ryan, you know, what did those birds think? Was it because it was foggy? Was it because you were just perfectly on the X where they wanted to feed? You know, which is probably really good odds. Did they think you're just, you know, some musky fishermen up there, and they just didn't, you know, give two cares in the world? Now, what would have been real curious to me is if you would have had a boat blind up, and if the scenario would have been slightly skewered in one way or the other, how it would have shook out, you know. So, what we had to follow up on what you were saying is at one time I had a boat blind, and I had a spot. It was fresh birds. They'd never been shot at. It was the beginning of October. First light, the birds came in perfectly, just like they were supposed to, right where I wanted them. Bang, 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 we shot some birds. Well, as that sun came up, all these birds started short-stopping the decoys 30, 40 yards out, and we either weren't getting shots or we had to take shots that we didn't want. And what ended up happening was we had shot at a flock of birds that, you know, maybe skimmed in a little bit closer than they should have. And when I took the boat out of the decoy spread to go pick the dead birds up, more flocks were coming in, and they were, again, landing perfectly right in the hole where I wanted them. So that told me that boat had to have been doing something wrong. So what I ended up doing is I took the boat and I parked it way down the shoreline and I hoofed it on back, and I got back, sat up in my decoys. It's just standing in the water and hunkered up next to a cattail clump. And me and a buddy, a couple buddies, we limited out in probably the next 10, 15 minutes. Every flock that came in was feet down in the hole landing. And it was all simply because I moved my 19-foot boat blind out of the cattails I had it stashed in. So, you know, had I not noticed that, would we have got our birds? Probably, but we might have had to sit there a lot longer. And, you know, maybe we wouldn't have got a full limit. Maybe we would have, you know, again, who knows. But just by getting that boat out at that particular instant made a huge difference in our hunt immediately. So, again, it's all about being perceptive and reading the conditions and what's happening.
Yeah, whether it's moving a mojo, moving decoys, pulling some decoys in, or, you know, whatever you need to do, if they're not doing it right, fix something. Don't just suffer through it.
Right. And, you know, I'm usually not the guy that's out there messing with decoys a lot or moving a mojo. But, you know, sometimes you have to, and sometimes that is the deal breaker if you're, you know, things are a little off. I had a buddy this year. He says, you know, I've had it before where I've had my two long lines out, and one of them is just angled a little bit differently. And, you know, the birds, same thing, would come in, but they just wouldn't quite finish just right. And he said, you know, I never really thought so, but I went out and I moved the long line just a few degrees one way or the other, and it made all the difference in the world. You know, some days these ducks don't care, and other days, you know, they can be really, really picky. So it's, you know, if things aren't working, it's definitely good to start messing around with stuff at least a little bit. And I mean, sometimes you got to know when messing with stuff is just messing with stuff and it's not actually doing anything either. I mean, some days, you know, I don't care what you do. It isn't going to work. Birds just don't want no part of it. But it's okay to, you know, try to experiment a little bit, you know, and figure out if little changes will make a difference or not. So definitely.
For sure. Well, we are long out of time, but this has been awesome. There's nothing better than duck hunting or talking about duck hunting, except maybe duck hunting itself. So,
right. I could, you know, that's probably my biggest flaw. I can just sit here and ramble on about nothing and nothing and nothing. So, you know, on those slow days of duck hunting, I'm a good guy to have in a boat because I can bore you with useless knowledge all day long. So,
well, I always say there are worse things to be addicted to. So, let's go with that.
For sure.
Captain Steve, R&D Guide Service. Steve, so duck season's over for you, right?
Yep.
What are you moving into next?
Well, we do have the two-day late season. Well, I hunt the two-day split in zone two and zone three, so I do have a little bit of that to look forward to yet. But other than that, I'm going to start putting all my stuff away. I've got shot up decoys that need repairs. I've got decoys that need to be burlapped. I don't know how hardcore I'm going to go at that. I usually like to wait until about a week before opening day, the following season. So I'm going to relax, take it easy. I'm looking forward to getting into some ice fishing. I do a lot of ice fishing down on Saginaw Bay. So, yeah, if somebody's interested in some walleye fishing and wants to sit in a nice shanty and talk to me about fishing or duck hunting, I'm all for that too. So, the next month or so with the holidays, I'm going to kind of hermit up a little bit and catch up on a couple hours of lost sleep, and then I'll be hard at the old fishing again.
Do you have openings for the splits or no?
I have openings for the zone 3 split if the weather, such allows. I don't typically book it. It's kind of a short notice thing I'll throw on Facebook, just because of weather, launches are froze. It might be open water. There might be lots of birds. There might be no birds. I usually don't book it, honestly, just for those reasons. For me as a guide, it's just a lot of variables that I don't like to mess with. It's about like opening day. I know a lot of guides love getting people out on opening day. I hate opening day just for the simple fact that, about the time that I've put in scouting all week long to find birds, just to find that, 20 other people did too, and we're all sitting on top of each other, call balling the heck out of them. So I like having my hunters on good hunts. And if I can keep other hunters out of that variable, I usually do. So, but like I said, who knows? Zone 3, there is a potential there. If, I find something good between now and the end of the month, I might throw something on Facebook room for a couple people. So, keep an eye on the old Facebook page. And you never know, maybe you'll get lucky and we'll get to hang out yet this year.
So follow R&D Guide Service on Facebook, and you can keep an eye out if that late split opens up, and if you can go out and kill some ducks on the late split. And
yep.
If Steve tells you there's ducks there, they're probably ducks.
Yep, and I will add too, because it seems to be a lot of questions I get. I can definitely start booking for next year. If guys want to get at me, because I was filled last year every day by, pretty much April. So if somebody wants to get a spot, get at me soon, and we can talk about getting you on the calendar. I am looking to get a couple more captains as well, and maybe getting a few more people out too. So we'll see. I'm looking into some more options to get some more hunters out too. I've had some guys asking me about, going more in depth with like layout hunting and diver duck hunting in particular. So I don't know. I might even, start doing a few more live feeds or Q&As on the web or the Facebook page too. Because guys want to ask questions and, go from there. So. Something to look forward to. I might try some new things. I'm not a real tech savvy guy. I'm a hunter and I'm a fisherman. I'm not a big online guy as far as a lot of that stuff goes. But I'm going to try and maybe my New Year's resolution be a little bit better about some of that stuff and try to be put myself out there for more customers to, or even any hunter, not just customers, but to. Q&A at me, so we can all go out there and have a better time in the outdoors.
And if someone's looking at getting into layout hunting, doing a couple guided hunts is a great way to learn, right?
Yeah, by far. Like I said, it's going to speed up your learning process tenfold. I've got a system. And my system, it's how guys are going to get in and out of layout boats. It's how guys are going to handing firearms back and forth to each other. It's how guys are going to, where they're shooting, what they're shooting at. Because, let's be honest, where I hunt in the Great Lakes, I see a lot of loons. And I don't want my hunters shooting loons. So I carry diagrams. And I show my hunters diagrams of what a winter phase loon looks like. Sometimes we get western grebes. We can't shoot western grebes. And I want my hunters to know what they are. Two-way radios, I use hand signals, lots of different things to be in touch. And anyways, a lot of guys getting into layout hunting don't know about this stuff. And they go with the experienced layout hunter, you can really shorten your learning curve, how to run the long lines in wind and how to anchor layout boats, how to get in, how to get out. So you're not flipping out of the boat, so you're not dropping your shotguns or your ammo in the lake. It's all good things to learn before you go doing it on your own. I won't take up too much of your time, but again, a quick little story is I took some young guys, teenagers out layout hunting for the first time. We had a great day. They shot a limit of ducks. They went back out a few days later in basically a bass boat and some kayaks for the most part. And needless to say, the weather picked up, the wind waves picked up. They flipped the kayaks. There's a couple of shotguns on the bottom of Lake Huron, along with some ammo. Both of them, very lucky. They were able to get back to the tender boat and the tender boat driver. All three of these guys, good friends of mine now, but lucky that they got back into the tender boat and got back to shore. One guy in particular, a good friend of mine, he tells me all the time it scarred him a little bit. He's a little scared now to go out on the big water because he had an accident. So rather than have that stuff happen, definitely good to go out with an experienced hunter that knows what they're doing and learn the correct way to do things so you don't get yourself in trouble.
Well, we appreciate you joining us. And what's the best way for people to get a hold of you?
By far the best way to get a hold of me is either on the R&D Guide Service Facebook page or my personal page, Stephen Schnaltz, on Facebook. A lot of people are there. Or simply call or text me. I will tell you that text is generally better because I am fantastic at putting my phone down and walking away, so I miss a lot of phone calls. But either online or give me a call or shoot me a text. Phone number should be on the Facebook page, or it is area code 616-466-2982. And like I said, text messages, phone calls fine too if I happen to have my phone. But online, it doesn't matter. Messenger, whatever works. I can make myself available. So
616-466-2982. It's R&D Guide Service, Stephen Schnaltz. And if you're looking for any sort of walleye fishing, ice fishing, or diver sea duck hunting for next season. And if you missed that number, don't worry. We'll put it in the description below wherever this is posted. Steve, thank you so much for joining us today and congrats on a great season. And definitely look forward to talking with you again and hunting with you next season, hopefully.
Perfect. I'd love to have you. Thank you.
Sounds good. Have a good one.
Yep. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, thanks for listening to the interview with Steve Schnaltz, R&D Guide Service. A great talk. It was pretty long. It was a little bit longer than I intended, but I wasn't going to cut it off. There was lots of great information in there. So I hope that it served you well. I hope you enjoyed it. If you're going to book a hunt in the Great Lakes, I highly recommend Steve. There are lots of great guides in the Great Lakes. Steve's the one that we recommend, and he's not paying me to say this. I've hunted with him. Fantastic experience, a safe experience. And you'll learn a lot and you'll hear some good stories, probably a lot more than you even heard today. So as you noticed, we had a few technical issues during the recording of that interview. Unfortunately, you'll probably hear a few more of these as time goes on, but we're going to try to tweak and figure this out as best we can. If you're still listening at this point, hopefully something was done right. Hopefully you've enjoyed the podcast this far. And I know that you're going to enjoy the next segment. Next segment, we're going to have Brad Sanders, owner of Dixie Decoys in North Carolina. Of course, Brad's going to be joining us from Australia, which we already talked about in the intro, but we're really excited for this next segment. If you're out shopping for Christmas gifts and you need some duck decoys, goose decoys, accessories, apparel, the random knickknacks for the waterfowler in your life, take a look at SuperiorDecoys.com. We've got free shipping over $100. And December 13th, so Friday the 13th, December 13th, that's in 2 days from the time this podcast is airing, at 3 p.m. Eastern Time is going to be the cutoff for Christmas shipments. And that's just the cutoff for the time that we guarantee that you'll get a package by Christmas. Unfortunately, you know, we have a lot going on. And with the holidays, you just have to deal with bogged down shipping companies as well. So Postal Service, FedEx, and UPS are going to be delayed as well, just simply because of their volume. So they're doing their best. We're doing our best. But if you need to get your Christmas orders, SuperiorDecoys.com, everything over 100 bucks ships free. But this is an advertisement, so we're going to get right to the segment with Brad Sanders, Dixie Decoys. Thanks for listening to the Great Lakes Waterfowl Podcast. I'm Dan Miller. Well, welcome back to the Great Lakes Waterfowl Podcast. Thanks for sticking with us. We're excited to be joined by Brad Sanders, the owner of Dixie Decoys and Waterman Sporting Company, North Carolina. Brad, welcome to the Great Lakes Waterfowl Podcast. Appreciate you joining us.
Hey, Dan. Thanks for having me on. And just one point of clarification. I am actually not in North Carolina. I'm in the great land down under in Australia. My military service has me all the way down here, which creates an interesting dynamic when trying to direct a company from literally the other side of the world. But we have a great team that really makes it all happen. So, yeah. Thanks for having me on.
So I think this topic that I'm kind of bringing up right now is important to waterfowling, obviously, or we wouldn't be talking about it. But it's particularly interesting to your brand, my brand. We've talked a lot about social media marketing and how it affects waterfowling and the conduct of waterfowlers in general. And so I think something that's important for us to look at is this new world that we live in with social media. And obviously, I'm a big proponent of social media. I love it. I wouldn't have a business without social media, if we're being honest. But there are hunters who have really become influential on social media through YouTube and other mediums. And the reality is that many of these very popular YouTube hunters do a lot of unethical stuff, a lot of things that are questionable. I've seen some of them where they're doing flat-out illegal things. And so I kind of want to get your thoughts on it. Obviously, there are good ones, there are bad ones, there are kind of middle of the road ones, and what they do with their YouTube channels or whatever is kind of up to them. But the question is, you know, is it beneficial to the sport? Is it damaging waterfowling? Is it damaging our reputation? What are your thoughts on these social media hunters? You know, some of the videos that have been put out, and there are a lot of different examples. I'm not going to give specifics, but you know what I'm talking about, and I'm just curious to hear your thoughts, and we'll go from there.
Sure. I certainly have some thoughts. I don't know that I'm a qualified authority in some sort of authoritative source on the sociographics of the effect of social media on the outdoor sports. You know, I'm just a hunter and a concerned citizen. I'm a member of the community just like you. And as a member of the community, I think we all have opinions, and it's important that we share those and respect one another's opinions when we do that. I think it's important that we, you know, before you even start to diagnose what the problem, if there even is a problem, you have to just understand the reality of the environment you're in. And so, you know, there seems to be like a negative connotation almost to the medium itself. And by that means, by that, I mean social media. And so social media itself is destroying waterfowl. But the conversation, this is not unique to waterfowl, right? Like this is the same thing that happens. But you know, you can talk about any other sort of sub niche of the hunting industry or fishing industry, and then it's the same conversation. But it extends beyond that to politics. It extends beyond that to matters of business, right? And so what you have is you've created this community forum that has never existed before, that has provided an opportunity for people to share their views and share their experiences. And then by virtue of sharing those things, you open it up to others for commenting and their sort of pundancy on those matters. And so this is new to everybody, right? Like there's no, where is the manual for how to deal with an unprecedented social sphere that has never existed before. And so what you're seeing is us grappling with that. And again, this is not, you know, this is not unique to the waterfowl community. This is across, you know, modern society. Is every little interest niche is dealing with this, you know? So I just caution, you know, myself and others before, because oftentimes you might categorize this as if I can oversimplify it for a second, you might see it the common phrase is, oh, the millennials and social media are ruining everything, and then,
right,
you know, the retort will be, well, you know, you made it this way, or this is a product of you, or so there's this back and forth, right? And that doesn't appreciate, I don't think, the nuance of the scenario and the reality of what's going on. And it also just, you know, if anybody's going to blame the forum, the public forum, you know, people used to meet in a marketplace and share ideas. And so when that was new, where were the people saying that, oh, this isn't how we used to do it, therefore it's ruining everything? No, that's just the venue for which we are sharing opinions. For me, and I think this is what you're getting at, for me, it's how you are sharing those opinions and those experiences that you have. And so it's not just opinions, it's your experiences and it's how are you sharing those things, but more specifically, how are you representing yourself and representing your community when you share your opinions and experiences? Understanding that there are people, you know, so if we are in a town square and this is the section of the town square where all the duck hunters congregate, there might be other people meandering about that marketplace that might find their way to your corner that have not been to the duck hunting or even the hunting, you know, corner of the marketplace before. And when they peer in that, they may have come from a completely different area with an entirely different context and having never been exposed to this. And all of a sudden they're walking into this and what kind of conversations are they hearing? And by that, I mean, let's translate to social media. What kind of pictures are they seeing, right? What kind of conversations are they seeing? And I think if you're unexperienced, what the concerned citizens might you know, worry about is, what are those people who are not otherwise exposed to our way of life? What are they seeing, right? Because first impressions last longer than the initial impression itself, right? So how are we representing ourselves? And I think that's the problem, right? So there is, you know, I think there's some contention, if I can just commentate on not the issue itself, but sort of the debate over the issue. I think that, you know, there's some contention between what is perceived as the old way of doing things and the new way of doing things. I happen to be a proponent of what some might, you know, stereotype as the old way of doing things. That's kind of what our entire company, our entire organization, our brand philosophy is focused on, the old way of doing things. But it's even in our slogan, a new kind of old, it's an appreciation of the old and the tradition while adopting modern technology and modern materials and modern performance advantages and those sorts of things. And I think that extends to, you know, the introduction of social media into the public sphere. You know, you can't just say, well, while you are using social media to bash social media, to say it's ruining everything. Like the oxymoron that creates it, you know, in and of itself, you can't say that it's ruining everything and just pretend like, oh, well, if I just complain about it enough, it'll go away. Like, this is just a fact of life, and this is how people are going to communicate. You know, information will be shared and disseminated more rapidly and more widely than it ever has been before. And that's not going to shrink. It's only going to get that way. So if your concern is that, oh, well, people are cyber scouting, which is, that's not good, right? There are things about this that I think we need to police ourselves about. But if you're concerned about these sorts of things, merely just complaining about it is is not going to do anything about it, right? I think where we need to focus our concern is trying to mentor ourselves. And this is, you know, in the military, you'd be experienced with this. It's, you know, police your own. Like, we need to take care of our own. And before we even start policing our own, by that, I mean those outside of our person who share the community with us, how about we take care of ourselves? So it's very easy for us to sit here and say, you know, it's always that guy, right? There's this mythical, you ever notice there's this mythical individual who he's always the skybuster. He's always he parks 50 yards from you. He's always this guy. He's always that. But like who is that guy, right? Does that guy know he's that guy? But we go in the community sphere and we complain about it. But what I ask is, do you ever take the time to respectfully and diplomatically correct that individual or let them know that that's not acceptable? Do you ever do that? Or do you ever notice when you cut the corners yourself? And so this is my theory on that guy. That guy is you, Dan. That guy is me. Because if you've ever cut a corner, right? If you've ever one time you're like, nobody's around, I'm gonna shoot 5 minutes early. That doesn't speak to a systemic fault in your character. I'm the early shooter. That's me. I'm the skybuster. I guarantee you, those complaining about the skybuster have done it themselves. Maybe it's just the one or two times. Yeah. Well, guess what? That guy is you when you just, and I'm not talking about you, Dan, specifically. It's you royally when you cut that corner that one time. And when you just cut that corner the one time, and somebody who happens to not be cutting the corner at the moment, you know, they're seeing you do that. And then you're like, oh, the whole sport's ruined. This, everything's gone down the toilet because everybody's doing this now. No, it was just that one guy doing it that one time, just like you did that one guy. You did that one thing that one time. It doesn't speak to the totality of your character. It was just a lapse in judgment, a cutting of corners that you did, you know. But before we start trying to correct others, which I certainly encourage everybody to do, right, police our own. How about we police ourselves and hold ourselves to a higher standard, right? That's where, you know, we there's a saying like everybody wants to be a leader, right? Well, I can't be a leader because I'm not in charge of anybody. I directly challenge that. You always have an opportunity to be a leader if you are present in yourself. You can always start by leading yourself. So be a leader in your community. Absolutely. That's what we challenge our staff to do. Like, be a leader that affects a positive change, not just in waterfowling, but in your church, in your school, in your peer community, in your business. That's what we're doing in our business, is developing leaders, right? So if you don't have anybody under you, that doesn't mean you can't be a person of influence. You can start by influencing and leading yourself. And all of that directly relates to your conduct when you are afield. So that's a lot to digest. I'll let you chew on that for a minute and come back with whatever you have.
Well, I'm going to take a break to go on Facebook and complain about Mark Zuckerberg for a minute, if you'll excuse me. No, you know, I think you're spot on. When it comes to social media, it's such an incredible tool for us. I mean, I've met many really good friends and hunting buddies on Facebook and Instagram. And I don't just mean people that I like their pictures now. You know, I'm talking about people that I hunted with all season this year and last year and things like that. And, you know, building those connections is powerful. And social media is really one of the only ways that happened, or the internet in general, I guess. Before social media, it was kind of refuge forums or I don't know, maybe in a weirder sense, Craigslist. But we have such a huge responsibility when it comes to social media, especially if we've been given a broad influence. I don't want to take away from what you said about us as individuals cutting corners and kind of being that guy for that moment in time, because that's you're spot on there. But when it comes to social media responsibility, I mean, in my opinion, there are two areas that we have to be incredibly cognizant of. And those two areas would be how we're projecting the sport to fellow waterfowlers, as well as you know, new waterfowlers that are taking an interest in it, and influencing them in either the right or the wrong direction. And the other is how we're projecting the sport to non-waterfowlers. We talked.
That's correct.
We had a live, I did a live video the other day and was kind of talking about our non-hunting allies that we should have, that we have in the UP. You know, we've worked with, bird rescue centers and stuff like that to provide decoys for, young birds that have been injured and stuff like that to mimic a mother bird as they're healing and things like that. And in other ways, and a lot of the people that are involved in these, bird related activities, whether it's bird watching or bird rescue or any sort of wildlife organization, they're kind of, a lot of them are kind of on the fence. They don't really have an opinion either way. And that video or that picture posted on social media might sway them one way or the other. You know, they can be our biggest supporters or they can be our biggest enemies, and they're never going to pick up a shotgun.
Yeah, you're so right. Like, you know, what we consider people that you know, it's in America, we're very fortunate. There's certainly an anti-hunting sentiment, right? But it is, it's
like
rather
four of those people, for being honest.
Yeah, it's buffeted by a rich and long storied history, you know, in hunting tradition. It's so we're sort of protected against that. Like here in Australia, the anti-hunting community, and really, it's odd. The specific targeting of waterfowl hunting, they're rabid. They're absolutely rabid, right? And so, you know, Australian waterfowlers, they make mistakes as well. But as a whole, I think, outsider looking in, their community is much more effective at policing their own. You see it in the build-up to opening day, like, hey guys, let's make sure we're out there doing the right thing. We're not shooting, because the protesters will be out there in the marsh with them, right? And like with cameras in their faces and everything. So if there's, you know, they really need to be on their best behavior to make sure that they're not giving the opposition any ammunition. But what's more is, the Australian population, and I would say this is probably the case in America too, North America, is like, if you're not a hunter, you're not against it. You're just like, oh, I just never did it, but like, that's fine. Maybe I had venison from that weird uncle that showed up one time, and he you know, he's a big hunter, but we never saw him. So that's about the most that I've ever had to hunting, but I'm okay with it. Like, so long as I'm just agnostic. I don't really have an opinion. Yeah, but as soon as you start scrolling through social media and you start seeing pictures of people, obviously, you know, this video recently of those two teens in Pennsylvania, like, I don't even want to mention it. It's so disheartening, but that, like, that's going to take those people who are otherwise agnostic and might even be willing to, like, you know, come out and see what it's about, that's going to push them to the other side, you know? So you said it, like, you know, we need to be concerned with how we're representing ourselves to the exterior community, but also, and this is the challenge that I want to get to the individual, right? Because there seems to just, like, look, there's only so much sort of, hey man, you know, you shouldn't really be doing that, but you can't tell me what to do. And you know, you're obviously going to get that sort of, oh, you're just a wuss, you don't want to see blood. Well, no, I just, you know, let's be reasonable here. And so the question that I want to ask, if you're taking a picture, and this is really gets to the root of what I'm passionate about, in that millennials aren't the problem, guys. I'm here to tell you, millennials aren't the problem. The old folks, the quote unquote old folks, aren't the problem. It's how we represent ourselves, and how we represent ourselves is, what are the stories that we are telling? Yeah, because you are willfully telling a story. That's why you put it in the public sphere, right? So when you do that, you open up yourself to commentary on your story. So I would just ask that you consider, what story are you telling with the pictures that you post? And so putting the biting the head off of a duck, and I don't care if Phil Robertson did it or not. That doesn't, in my mind, that doesn't make it correct. It doesn't make you more of a man. But biting the head off of a duck, or putting the bill in the barrel, right? Or taking, I saw a picture of a guy who posed a hypothetically posed a question like, who likes big bucks or something? And there it was, this beautiful, beautiful buck, which he put the arm up inside the antlers to make it look like it was raising its hand. And so the question I posed to him and what I would pose to your audience is, do the pictures you post, again, you are willfully telling the public sphere a story, does that sufficiently do justice to the effort that you put into getting to that point? Think about, like, so if you're going to take a picture with where you're, you know, laying on top of a pile of birds, you know, does that, think about everything that got to that point, that took to get to that point. So not even you, let's talk about the animal, right? And the breeding cycle that had to happen and all of all of the energy that Mother Nature had to put into, you know, the feed to feed that animal so that they could breed, so that they could migrate, so that they could get to there at that point in time. And so that you could have many months ago, prepped your decoys, done the scouting, you know, woken up early, been cold, all of this stuff. And in the totality of that experience, you're going to, that's a massive story, right? Like you could write a novel of that. In the totality of that, you're going to represent in one picture. And the picture you choose is you biting the head off of a duck or putting the bill in a barrel or otherwise disrespecting the animal, right? So if that's for you, man, like this is where I have to stop commenting on what's acceptable for you, because if it's legal, it's legal, right? But if that's how you think that you are telling, you know, most effectively telling your story that you obviously want to tell people, I would just ask, you know, maybe there might be another option for you to do that. And so the approach that we take is, you know, through a mantra of honor the hunt, honor the harvest. And you might, you know, honor the hunt by honoring the harvest. And so that's kind of what the philosophy that we take into it.
I think that's a great philosophy. And we are running really low on time, but I would love to discuss this in a future podcast where we can explore this for the full hour.
Anytime, man. Anytime.
There's not a good point to cut this off, but I love what you guys are doing at Dixie and keeping that respectful message of the harvest and the hunt and just maintaining a professional image for waterfowlers. I mean, we are probably a generation away from losing it, and it probably isn't going to be from anti-hunters. It'll probably be from people who just didn't replace. I'm going to cut that out. I don't think if we lose waterfowling, I don't think it's going to be due to the attacks of anti-hunters. I think that they're a small enough minority in the United States that they really don't pose a threat. I think we are our own worst enemy, and that goes to what you talked about, policing ourselves as individuals and as a community. And I think that we can really enhance waterfowling for our children and ourselves in the future by being a little bit more conscious about how we're representing the sport.
Well, I think that's important. I mean, the sport of waterfowling is not too far from not being around anymore if we're not careful. And I think in many ways we can be our own worst enemies by not maintaining a respectful image. And it might not be the anti-hunters that cause waterfowling to spiral. It could very well be our own conduct and failing to attract new people to the sport. The importance of maintaining that classy waterfowler image is I use the word classy, but I mean, in reality, it's just respectful of the game and respectful of the creation and the creator that has given us this incredible world. So appreciate what you guys are doing at Dixie. I really love the branding and the way that you maintain that image for waterfowling. Of course, we know that we kill ducks. We know that we're killing animals, but we can be respectful of the harvest. We can honor that and preserve this for generations to come. So appreciate that philosophy, and it's important.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I consider what you're doing with your business and your brand, just how you conduct yourself. You are definitely a leader among us. So thank you for that.
Same to you. And Brad Sanders, Dixie Decoys, Waterman Sporting Company. Brad, always a pleasure, and we will definitely catch up again.
Okay, buddy. Thanks.
Take care.
Well, thank you for listening to the Great Lakes Waterfowl Podcast, the first episode. I truly appreciate your joining us. Hope that those interviews were helpful to you and enjoyable and help pass some time, hopefully, and get you fired up for next season. Don't forget to join us next week as we discuss similar topics, as we talk about waterfowling, waterfowl ethics, tactics, guides, and who knows what else. I mean, we got spring snow goose coming up, so that's going to obviously get us fired up, and we'll have some guests that are going to talk about that. If you'd like to get a hold of Steve or Brad, either of our guests, their info will be in the description below. Don't forget to check out superiordecoys.com, where you can get free shipping over $100. Anything over $100 ships free, and we've got hundreds of items that ship free regardless of the price. So a lot of apparel, toe tags, calls, all sorts of things are going to ship free for you. So superiordecoys.com. Thanks for listening to the Great Lakes Waterfowl Podcast. We'll see you next time.